vine, and with a sudden rending pop, the potato vine lifted up, and the earth revealed its bounty. A collective, "Ah!" went up from the spectators, at sight of the myriad brown globules clinging to the roots of the uprooted vine. Ian and I both fell to our knees in the dirt, scrabbling in the loosened soil for potatoes severed from the parent vine. "It worked," Ian kept saying, as he pulled potato after potato out of the ground. "Look at that. See the size of it."
"Yes, look at this one," I exclaimed in delight, brandishing one the size of my two fists held together.
At length, we had the produce of our sample vine laid in a basket. Perhaps 10 good-sized potatoes, 25 or so fist-sized specimens, and a number of small things the size of golf balls.
"What do you think?"
Jamie scrutinized our collection quizzically.
"Ought we to leave the rest so the little ones will grow more, or take them now before the cold comes?"
Ian groped absently for his spectacles, then remembered that Sir Walter was over by the fence, and abandoned the effort. He shook his head.
"No, I think this is right," he said. "The book says you keep the bitty ones for the seed potatoes for next year. We'll want a lot of those."
He gave me a grin of relieved delight, his hank of thick, straight brown hair dropping across his forehead. There was a smudge of dirt down the side of his face. One of the cotter's wives was bending over the basket, peering at its contents. She reached out a tentative finger and prodded one of the potatoes.
"He eat them, you see."
Her brow creased sceptically.
"I dinna see how you'd ever grind them in a quern for bread or porridge."
"Well, I dinna believe you grind them, Mistress Murray," Jamie explained courteously.
"Oh, hi."
The woman squinted censoriously at the basket.
"Well, what do you do with them, then?"
"Well, you..."
Jamie started and then stopped. It occurred to me, as it no doubt had to him, that while he had eaten potatoes in France, he had never seen one prepared for eating. I hid a smile as he stared helplessly at the dirt-crusted potato in his hand. Ian also stared at it, apparently as Sir Walter was mute on the subject of potato cooking.
"You roast them,"
Fergus came to the rescue once more, bobbing up under Jamie's arm. He smacked his lips at the sight of the potatoes.
"Put them in the coals of the fire. You eat them with salt. Butter's good, if you have it."
"We have it,"
said Jamie, with an air of relief. He thrust the potato at Mrs. Murray, as though anxious to be rid of it.
"You roast them," he informed her firmly.
"You can boil them too," I contributed. "Or mash them with milk, or fry them, or chop them up and put them in soup. A very versatile vegetable, the potato."
"That's what the book says," Ian murmured with satisfaction.
Jamie looked at me, the corner of his mouth curling in a smile.
"You never told me you could cook, Sassenach."
"I wouldn't call it cooking exactly," I said, "but I probably can boil a potato."
"Good."
Jamie cast an eye at the group of tenants and their wives, who were passing the potatoes from hand to hand, looking them over rather dubiously. He clapped his hands loudly to attract attention.
"We'll be having supper here by the field," he told them. "Let's be fetching a bit of wood for a fire, Tom and Willie. And, Mrs. Willie, if you'd be so kind as to bring your big kettle."
"Aye, that's good.
One of the men will help you to bring it down. You, Kincaid."
He turned to one of the younger men and waved off in the direction of the small cluster of cottages under the trees.
"Go and tell everyone it's potatoes for supper."
And so, with the assistance of Jenny, 10 pails of milk from the dairy shed, 3 chickens caught from the coop, and 4 dozen large leeks from the kale yard, I presided over the preparation of cock-a-leeky soup and roasted potatoes for the laird and tenants of Lallybroch. The sun was below the horizon by the time the food was ready, but the sky was still alight, with streaks of red and gold that lanced through the dark branches of the pine grove on the hill. There was a little hesitation when the tenants came face to face with the proposed addition to their diet,
but the party-like atmosphere, helped along by a judicious keg of home-brewed whiskey, overcame any misgivings, and soon the ground near the potato field was littered with the forms of impromptu diners, hunched over balls held on their knees.
"What do you think, Dorcas?" I overheard one woman say to her neighbour. "It's a wee bit queer-tasting, no?"
Dorcas, so addressed, nodded and swallowed before replying.
"Aye, it is. But the laird's eaten 6 of the things so far, and they havena killed him yet."
The response from the men and children was a good deal more enthusiastic, likely owing to the generous quantities of butter supplied with the potatoes.
"Men would eat horse droppings if you served them with butter," Jenny said, in answer to an observation along these lines. "Men! A full belly and a place to lie down when they're drunk, and that's all they ask of life."
"I wonder he put up with Jamie and me,"
Ian teased, hearing her.
"Seeing you've such a low opinion of men."
Jenny waved her soup ladle dismissively at husband and brother, seated side by side on the ground near the kettle.
"Oh, you two aren't men."
Ian's feathery brows shot upward, and Jamie's thicker red ones matched them.
"Oh, we're not. Well, what are we then?" Ian demanded.
Jenny turned toward him with a smile, white teeth flashing in the firelight. She patted Jamie on the head and dropped a kiss on Ian's forehead.
"You're mine," she said.
After supper, one of the men began to sing. Another brought out a wooden flute and accompanied him, the sound thin but piercing in the cold autumn night. The air was chilly, but there was no wind, and it was cosy enough, wrapped in shawls and blankets, huddled in small family clusters round the fire. The blaze had been built up after the cooking, and now made a substantial dent in the darkness. It was warm, if a trifle active, in our own family huddle. Ian had gone to fetch another armload of wood, and baby Maggie clung to her mother, forcing her elder brother to seek refuge and body warmth elsewhere.
"I'm going to stick you upside down in yonder kettle, and you dinna leave off poking me in the balls," Jamie informed his nephew, who was squirming vigorously on his uncle's lap. "What's the matter, then? Have you got ants in your drawers?"
This query was greeted with a gale of giggles and a marked effort to burrow into his host's midsection. Jamie groped in the dark, making deliberately clumsy grabs at his namesake's arms and legs, then wrapped his arms around the boy and rolled suddenly over on top of him, forcing a startled whoop of delight from small Jamie. Jamie pinned his nephew forcibly to the ground and held him there with one hand while he groped blindly on the ground in the dark. Seizing a handful of wet grass with a grunt of satisfaction, he raised himself enough to jam the grass down the neck of small Jamie's shirt, changing the giggling to a high-pitched squeal, no less delighted.
"There, then," Jamie said, rolling off the small form. "Go plague your auntie for a bit."
Small Jamie obligingly scrambled over to me on hands and knees, still giggling, and nestled on my lap among the folds of my cloak. He sat as still as is possible for an almost 4-year-old boy, which is not very still, all things considered, and let me remove the bulk of the grass from his shirt.
"You smell nice, auntie," he said,
buffing my chin affectionately with his mop of black curls.
"Like food."
"Well, thank you," I said. "Ought I to take that to mean you're hungry again?"
"Aye. Is there milk?"
"There is." I could just reach the stoneware jug by stretching out my fingers. I shook the bottle, decided there wasn't enough left to make it worthwhile to fetch a cup, and tilted the jug, holding it for the little boy to drink from. Temporarily absorbed in the taking of nourishment, he was still, the small, sturdy body heavy on my thigh, back braced against my arm as he wrapped his own pudgy hands around the jug. The last drops of milk gurgled from the jug. Small Jamie relaxed all at once, and emitted a soft burp of repletion. I could feel the heat glowing from him, with that sudden rise of temperature which presages falling asleep in very young children. I wrapped a fold of the cloak around him and rocked him slowly back and forth, humming softly to the tune of the song beyond the fire. The small bumps of his vertebrae were round and hard as marbles under my fingers.
Gone to sleep, has he?
The larger Jamie's bulk loomed near my shoulder, the firelight picking out the hilt of his dirk and the gleam of copper in his hair.
Yes, I said. At least he's not squirming, so he must have. It's rather like holding a large ham.
Jamie laughed, then was still himself. I could feel the hardness of his arm just brushing mine, and the warmth of his body through the folds of plaid and arised. A night breeze brushed a strand of hair across my face. I brushed it back and discovered that small Jamie was right. My hands smelled of leeks and butter and the starchy smell of cut potatoes. Asleep, he was a dead weight, and while holding him was comforting, he was cutting off the circulation in my left leg. I twisted a bit, intending to lay him across my lap.
"Don't move, Sassenach,"
Jamie's voice came softly next to me.
"Just for a moment, Mudunya. Be still."
I obligingly froze until he touched me on the shoulder.
"That's all right, Sassenach,"
he said, with a smile in his voice.
"It's only that you looked so beautiful with the fire on your face and your hair weaving in the wind. I wanted to remember it."
I turned to face him then, and smiled at him across the body of the child. The night was dark and cold, alive with people all around, but there was nothing where we sat but light and warmth and each other. Chapter 33. Thy Brother's Keeper. Fergus, after an initial period of silent watchfulness from corners, had become a part of the household, taking on the official position of stable lad, along with young Rabbi McNab. While Rabbi was a year or two younger than Fergus, he was as big as the slight French lad, and they quickly became inseparable friends, except on the occasions when they argued, which was two or three times a day, and then attempted to kill each other. After a fight one morning had escalated into a punching, kicking, fist-swinging brawl that rolled through the dairy shed and spilled two pannikins of cream set out to sour, Jamie took a hand. With an air of long-suffering grimness, he had taken each other miscreant by the scruff of a skinny neck and removed them to the privacy of the barn, where, I assumed, he overcame any lingering scruples he might have had about the administration of physical retribution. He strode out of the barn, shaking his head and buckling his belt back on, and left with Ian to ride up the valley to Broch Morda. The boys had emerged some time later, substantially subdued and, united in tribulation, once more the best of friends. Sufficiently subdued, in fact, to allow young Jamie to tag along with them as they did their chores. As I glanced out the window later in the morning, I saw the three of them playing in the dooryard with a ball made of rags. It was a cold, misty day, and the boys' breath rose in soft clouds as they galloped and shouted. "Nice, sturdy little lad you've got there," I remarked to Jenny, who was sorting through her mending basket in search of a button. She glanced up, saw what I was looking at, and smiled.
"Ooh, aye. Wee Jamie's a dear lad."
She came to join me by the window, peering out at the game below.
"He's the spit of his da," she remarked fondly, "but he's going to be a good bit wider through the shoulder, I think. He'll maybe be the size of his uncle. See those legs?"
I thought she was probably right. While small Jamie, nearly four, still had the chunky roundness of a toddler, his legs were long, and the small back was wide and flat with muscle. He had the long, graceful bones of his uncle, and the same air his larger namesake projected, of being composed of something altogether tougher and springier than mere flesh. I watched the little boy pounce on the ball, scoop it up with a deft snatch, and throw it hard enough to sail past the head of Rabbi McNab, who raced off, shouting, to retrieve it.
"Something else is like his uncle," I said. "I think he's maybe going to be left-handed, too."
"Oh, God,"
said Jenny, brow furrowed as she peered at her offspring.
"I hope not, but you're maybe right."
She shook her head, sighing.
"Lord, when I think of the trouble poor Jamie had from being corrie-fisted. Everybody tried to break him of it, from my parents to the schoolmaster, but he was always stubborn as a log and wouldn't budge. Everybody but Ian's father, at least, she added as an afterthought.
He didn't think being left-handed was wrong, I asked curiously, aware that the general opinion of the times was that left-handedness was at best unlucky, and at the worst a symptom of demonic possession. Jamie wrote, with difficulty, with his right hand, because he had been beaten regularly at school for picking up the quill with his left. Jenny shook her head, black curls bobbing under her kerch.
No. He was a queer man, old John Murray. He said, if the Lord had chosen to strengthen Jamie's left arm so, then 'twould be a sin to spurn the gift. And he was a rare man wi' a sword, old John. So my father listened, and he let Jamie learn to fight left-handed.
I thought Dougal Mackenzie taught Jamie to fight left-handed, I said. I rather wondered what Jenny thought of her Uncle Dougal.
She nodded, licking the end of a thread before putting it through the eye of her needle with one quick poke.
Aye, it was, but that was later, when Jamie was grown and went to foster wi' Dougal. It was Ian's father taught him his first strokes.
She smiled, eyes on the shirt in her lap.
I remember when they were young, and John told Ian it was his job to stand to Jamie's right, for he must guard his chief's weaker side in a fight. And he did. They took it very seriously, the two of them. And I suppose old John was right at that, she added, snipping off the excess thread. After a time nobody would fight them, not even the McNab lads. Jamie and Ian were both fair-sized and bonny fighters, and when they stood shoulder to shoulder, there was no one could take the pair of them down, even if they were outnumbered.
She laughed suddenly, and smoothed back a lock of hair behind her ear.
Watch them sometime when they're walking the field together. I dinna suppose they even realise they do it still, but they do. Jamie always moves to the left, so Ian can take up his place on the right, guarding the weaker side.
Jenny gazed out the window, the shirt momentarily forgotten in her lap, and laid a hand over the small swelling of her stomach.
I hope it's a boy, she said,
looking at her black-haired son below. Left-handed or no, it's good for a man to have a brother to help him. I caught her glance at the picture on the wall, a very young Jamie standing between the knees of his elder brother, Willie. Both young faces were snub-nosed and solemn. Willie's hand rested protectively on his little brother's shoulder.
"Jamie's lucky to have Ian," I said.
Jenny looked away from the picture and blinked once. She was 2 years older than Jamie. She would have been 3 years younger than William.
"Aye, he is. And so am I," she said softly, picking up the shirt once more.
I took a child's smock from the mending basket and turned it inside out to get at the ripped seam beneath the armhole. It was too cold out for anyone but small boys at play or men at work, but it was warm and cosy in the parlour. The windows fogged over quickly as we worked, isolating us from the icy world outside.
"Speaking of brothers," I said, squinting as I threaded my own needle, "did you see Dougal and Colum Mackenzie much as you were growing up?"
Jenny shook her head. "I've never met Colum. Dougal came here a time or two, bringing Jamie home for Hogmanay or such, but I canna say I know him well."
She looked up from her mending, slanted eyes bright with interest.
"You know them, though. Tell me, what's Colum Mackenzie like? I always wondered, from the bit of things I'd hear from visitors, but my parents never would speak of him."
She paused a moment, a crease between her brows.
"No, I'm wrong. My dad did say something about him once. 'Twas just after Dougal had left to go back to Benacht with Jamie. Thou was leaning on the fence outside, watching them ride out of sight, and I came up to wave to Jamie. It always grieved me sore when he left, for I didn't ken how long he'd be gone. Anyway, we watched them over the crest of the hill, and then Da stirred a bit and grunted and said,
God help Dougal Mackenzie when his brother Colum dies. Then he seemed to remember I was there, for he turned round and smiled at me and said, Well, lassie, what's for our dinner then? I wouldn't see more about it.
The black brows, fine and bold as the strokes of calligraphy, lifted in puzzled inquiry.
I thought that odd, for I'd heard, who hasn't, that Colum is sore crippled, and Dougal does the chief's work for him, collecting rents and settling claims, and leading the clan to battle when needs be.
He does, but I hesitated, unsure how to describe that odd symbiotic relationship.
Well, I said with a smile, the closest I can come is to tell you that once I overheard them arguing, and Colum said to Dougal, I'll tell you, if the brothers Mackenzie have but one cock and one brain between them, then I'm glad of my half of the bargain.
Jenny gave a sudden laugh of surprise, then stared at me, a speculative gleam deep in her blue eyes, so like her brother's.
Oh, so that's the way of it, is it?
I did wonder once, hearing Dougal talk about Colum's son, wee Hamish.
He seemed a bit fonder than an uncle might be.
You're quick, Jenny, I said, staring back at her. Very quick. It took me a long time to work that out, and I saw them every day for months. She shrugged modestly, but a small smile played about her lips.
I listen, she said simply, to what folk say and what they don't.
And people do gossip something terrible here in the Highlands.
So,
she bit off a thread and spat the end neatly into the palm of her hand,
tell me about Leoch. Folk say it's big, but not so grand as Bewley or Kilravach.
We worked and talked through the morning, moving from mending to winding wool for knitting, to laying out the pattern for a new baby dress for Maggie. The shouts from the boys outside ceased, to be replaced by murmurous noises and banging from the back of the house, suggesting that the younger male element had gotten cold and come to infest the kitchens instead.
I wonder, will it snow soon? Jenny said, with a glance at the window. There's wetness in the air. Did you see the haze over the loch this morning?
I shook my head.
I hope not. That will make it hard for Jamie and Ian coming back.
The village of Broch Moorda was less than 10 miles from Lallybroch, but the way lay over steadily rising hills, with steep and rocky slopes, and the road was little more than a deer track. In the event, it did snow, soon after noon, and the flakes kept swirling down long past nightfall.
"They'll have stayed in Broch Moorda," Jenny said, pulling her night-capped head in from an inspection of the cloudy sky with its snow-pink glow. "Dinna worry for them. They'll be tucked up cozy in someone's cottage for the night."
She smiled reassuringly at me as she pulled the shutters to. A sudden wail came from down the hall, and she picked up the skirts of her nightrobe with a muffled exclamation.
"Good night, Claire,"
she called, already hurrying off on her maternal errand of mercy.
"Sleep well."
I usually did sleep well. In spite of the cold, damp climate, the house was tightly constructed, and the goose-feather bed was plentifully supplied with quilts. Tonight, though, I found myself restless without Jamie. The bed seemed vast and clammy, my legs twitchy, and my feet cold. I tried lying on my back, hands lightly clasped across my ribs, eyes closed, breathing deep, to summon up a picture of Jamie. If I could imagine him there, breathing deeply in the dark beside me, perhaps I could fall asleep. The sound of a cock crowing at full blast lifted me off the pillow as though a stick of dynamite had been touched off beneath the bed.
Idiot,
I said, every nerve in my body twanging from the shock. I got up and cracked the shutter. It had stopped snowing, but the sky was still pale with cloud, a uniform colour from horizon to horizon. The rooster let loose another bellow in the hen coop below.
Shut up, I said. It's the middle of the night, you feathered bastard.
The avian equivalent of a raspberry echoed through the still night, and down the hall a child began to cry,
followed by a rich but muffled Gaelic expletive in Jenny's voice.
"You," I said to the invisible rooster, "are living on borrowed time."
There was no response to this, and after a pause to make certain that the rooster had in fact called it a night, I closed the shutters and did the same. The commotion had derailed any coherent train of thought. Instead of trying to start another, I decided to try turning inward in the hopes that physical contemplation would relax me enough to sleep. It worked. As I began to hover on the edge of sleep, my mind fixed somewhere around my pancreas, I could dimly hear the sounds of small Jamie pattering down the hall to his mother's bedroom. Roused from sleep by a full bladder, he seldom had the presence of mind to take the obvious step and would frequently blunder down the stair from the nursery in search of assistance instead. I had wondered, coming to Lallybroch, whether I might find it difficult to be near Jenny, if I would be envious of her easy fruitfulness. And I might have been, had I not seen that abundant motherhood had its price as well. "There's a pot right by your bed, Clotilde," Jenny's exasperated voice came outside my door as she steered small Jamie back to his bed. "You must have stepped in it on your way out. Why can ye no get it through your head to use that one? Why have you got to come to use mine every night in creation?" Her voice faded as she turned up the stair, and I smiled, visualization moving down the sweeping curve of my intestines. There was another reason I didn't envy Jenny. I had at first feared that the birth of Faith had done me some internal damage, but that fear had disappeared with Raymond's touch. As I felt my spine go slack on the edge of sleep, I could feel that all was well there. It had happened once, it could happen again. All that was needed was time, and Jamie. Jenny's footsteps sounded on the boards of the hallway, quickening in response to a sleepy squawk from Maggie at the far end of the house. "Bairns are certain joy, but nae small care," I murmured to myself, and fell asleep. Through the next day we waited, doing our chores and going through the daily routine with one ear cocked for the sound of horses in the dooryard. "They'll have stayed to do some business," Jenny said, outwardly confident. But I saw her pause every time she passed the window that overlooked the lane leading to the house. As for me, I had a hard time controlling my imagination. The letter, signed by King George, confirming Jamie's pardon, was locked in the drawer of the desk in the laird's study. Jamie regarded it as a humiliation and would have burned it, but I had insisted it be kept just in case. Now, listening for sounds through the rush of winter wind, I kept having visions of it having all been a mistake, or a hoax of some kind, of Jamie once more arrested by red-coated dragoons, taken away again to the misery of prison and the impending danger of the hangman's noose. The men returned at last, just before nightfall, horses laden with bags containing the salt, needles, pickling spice, and other small items that Lallybroch couldn't produce for itself. I heard one of the horses whinny as it came into the stable-yard, and ran downstairs, meeting Jenny on her way out through the kitchens. Relief swept through me as I saw Jamie's tall figure shadowed against the barn. I ran through the yard, disregarding the light covering of snow that lingered on the ground, and flung myself into his arms. "Where the hell have you been?" I demanded. He took time to kiss me before replying. His face was cold against mine, and his lips tasted faintly and pleasantly of whiskey.
"Sausage for supper," he said approvingly, sniffing at my hair, which smelled of kitchen smoke. "Good. I'm fair starved."
"Bangers and mash," I said. "Where have you been?" He laughed, shaking out his plaid to get the blown snow off.
"Bangers and mash? That's food, is it?"
"Sausages with mashed potatoes," I translated. "A nice traditional English dish, hitherto unknown in the benighted reaches of Scotland. Now, you bloody Scot, where in hell have you been for the last 2 days?
Jenny and I were worried.
Well, we had a wee accident, Jamie began, when he spotted the small figure of Fergus bearing a lantern.
Oh, you've brought a light then, Fergus. Good lad. Set it there, where you won't set fire to the straw, and then take this poor beast into her stall. When you've got her settled, come along to your own supper. You'll be able to sit to it by now, I expect.
He aimed a friendly cuff at Fergus's ear. The boy dodged and grinned back. Apparently, whatever had happened in the barn yesterday had left no hard feelings.
Jamie, I said in measured tones, if you don't stop talking about horses and sausages, and tell me what sort of accident you had, I am going to kick you in the shins. Which will be very hard on my toes, because I'm only wearing slippers. But I warn you, I'll do it anyway.
That's a threat, is it? He said, laughing. It wasn't a serious sassenach, only that...
Ian! Jenny, delayed momentarily by Maggie, had just arrived, in time to see her husband step into the circle of lantern light. Startled by the shock in her voice, I turned to see her dart forward and put a hand to Ian's face. "Whatever happened to you, man?" she said. Plainly, whatever the accident had been, Ian had borne the brunt of it. One eye was blackened and swollen half shut, and there was a long, raw scrape down the slope of one cheekbone.
"I'm all right, me do," he said,
patting Jenny gently as she embraced him, little Maggie squeezed uncomfortably between them.
"Only a bit bruised here and there. We were coming down the slope of the hill, 2 miles outside the village, leading the horses because the footing was bad, and Ian stepped in a molehole and broke his leg," Jamie explained. "The wooden one," Ian amplified. He grinned a little sheepishly. "The mole had a bit the best of that encounter. So we stayed at a cottage nearby long enough to carve him a new one," Jamie ended the story. "Can we eat? The sides of my belly are flapping together."
We went in without further ado, and Mrs. Crook and I served the supper while Jenny bathed Ian's face with witch hazel and made anxious inquiries about other injuries.
"It's nothing," he assured her, "only bruises here and there."
I had watched him coming into the house, though, and seen that his normal limp was badly exaggerated. I had a few quiet words with Jenny as we cleared away the supper plates, and once we were settled in the parlour, the contents of the saddlebags safely disposed of, she knelt on the rug beside Ian and took hold of the new leg.
"Let's have it off, then," she said firmly. "You've hurt yourself, and I want Claire to look it over. She can maybe help you more than I can."
The original amputation had been done with some skill and greater luck. The army surgeon who had taken the lower leg off had been able to save the knee joint. This gave Ian a great deal more flexibility of movement than he might otherwise have had. For the moment, though, the knee joint was more liability than an advantage. The fall had twisted his leg cruelly. The end of the stump was blue with bruising and lacerated where the sharp edge of the cuff had pressed through the skin. It must have been agony to set any weight on it, even had all else been normal. As it was, the knee had twisted too, and the flesh on the inside of the joint was swollen, red and hot. Ian's long, good-natured face was nearly as red as the injured joint. While perfectly matter-of-fact about his disability, I knew he hated the occasional helplessness it imposed. His embarrassment at being so exposed now was likely as painful to him as my touching of his leg. "You've torn a ligament through here," I told him, tracing the swelling inside his knee with a gentle finger. "I can't tell how bad it is, but bad enough. You've got fluid inside the joint. That's why it's swollen."
"Can you help it, Sassenach?"
Jamie was leaning over my shoulder, frowning worriedly at the angry-looking limb. I shook my head. "Not a lot I can do for it, beyond cold compresses to reduce the swelling." I looked up at Ian, fixing him with my best approximation of a Mother Hildegard look.
"What you can do," I said,
"is stay in bed. You can have whiskey for the pain tomorrow. Tonight I'll give you laudanum so you can sleep.
Keep off it for a week at least, and we'll see how it does.
I cannot do that, Ian protested. There's the stable wall needs mending, two dikes down in the upper field, and the ploughshares to be sharpened, and...
And a leg to mend, too, said Jamie firmly.
He gave Ian what I privately called his laird's look, a piercing blue glare that caused most people to leap to his bidding. Ian, who had shared meals, toys, hunting expeditions, fights and thrashings with Jamie, was a good deal less susceptible than most people.
"The hell I will," he said flatly.
His hot brown eyes met Jamie's with a look in which pain and anger mingled with resentment. And something else I didn't recognize.
"Do you think you can order me?"
Jamie sat back on his heels, flushing as though he'd been slapped. He bit back several obvious retorts, finally saying quietly,
"No, I will not try to order you. May I ask you, though, to care for yourself?"
A long look passed between the men, containing some message I couldn't read. At last, Ian's shoulders slumped as he relaxed, and he nodded with a crooked smile.
"You can ask."
He sighed and rubbed at the scrape on his cheekbone, wincing as he touched the abraded skin. He took a deep breath, steeling himself, then held out a hand to Jamie.
"Help me up, then."
It was an awkward job getting a man with one leg up two flights of stairs, but it was managed at last. At the bedroom door, Jamie left Ian to Jenny. As he stepped back, Ian said something soft and quick to Jamie in Gaelic. I was still not proficient in the tongue, but I thought he had said, "Be well, brother." Jamie paused, looking back, and smiled, the candle lighting his eyes with warmth.
"You too, Maubrère."
I followed Jamie down the hall to our own room. I could tell from the slump of his shoulders that he was tired, but I had a few questions I wanted to ask before he fell asleep.
"It's only bruises here and there," Ian had said, reassuring Jenny.
It was, here and there. Beside the bruises on his face and leg, I had seen the darkened marks that lay half hidden under the collar of his shirt. No matter how much Ian's intrusion had been resented, I couldn't imagine a mole trying to strangle him in retaliation. In the event, Jamie didn't want to sleep at once.
"Oh, absence makes the heart grow fonder, does it?" I said.
The bed, so vast the night before, now seemed scarcely big enough.
"Hmm,"
he said, eyes half closed in content.
"Oh, the heart? Aye, that too. Oh, God, don't stop. That feels wonderful."
"Don't worry, I'll do it some more," I assured him. "Let me put out the candle, though."
I rose and blew it out. With the shutters left open, there was plenty of light reflected into the room from the snowy sky, even without the candle's flame. I could see Jamie clearly, the long shape of his body relaxed beneath the quilts, hands curled half open at his side. I crawled in beside him and took up his right hand, resuming my slow massage of his fingers and palm. He gave a long sigh, almost a groan, as I rubbed a thumb in firm circles over the pads at the base of his fingers. Stiffened by hours of clenching around his horse's reins, the fingers warmed and relaxed slowly under my touch. The house was quiet, and the room cold outside the sanctuary of the bed. It was pleasant to feel the length of his body warming the space beside me, and enjoy the intimacy of touch with no immediate feeling of demand. In time, this touch might token more. It was winter, and the nights were long. He was there, so was I, and content with things as they were, for the moment. "Jamie," I said, after a time, "who hurt Ian?" He didn't open his eyes, but gave a long sigh before answering. He didn't stiffen in resistance, though. He had been expecting the question.
"I did," he said.
"What?" I dropped his hand in shock.
He closed his fist and opened it, testing the movements of his fingers. Then he laid his left hand on the counterpane beside it, showing me the knuckles slightly puffed by contact with the protuberances of Ian's bony countenance.
"Why?"
I said, appalled. I could tell that there was something new and edgy between Jamie and Ian, though it didn't look exactly like hostility. I couldn't imagine what might have made Jamie strike Ian. His brother-in-law was nearly as close to him as was his sister, Jenny.
Jamie's eyes were open now, but not looking at me. He rubbed his knuckles restlessly, looking down at them.
Aside from the mild bruising of his knuckles, there were no marks on Jamie. Apparently, Ian hadn't fought back.
"Well, Ian's been married too long," he said defensively.
"I'd say you'd been out in the sun too long," I remarked, staring at him. "Except that there isn't any. Have you got a fever?"
"No,"
he said, evading my attempts to feel his forehead.
"No, it's only..." "Stop that, Sassenach. I'm all right."
He pressed his lips together, but then gave up and told me the whole story. Ian had, in fact, broken his wooden leg by stepping into a molehole near Broch Moorda.
"It was near evening. We'd had a lot to do in the village, and snowing. And I could see Ian's leg was paining him a lot, even though he kept insisting he could ride. Anyway, there were two or three cottages near, so I got him up on one of the ponies and brought him up the slope to beg shelter for the night."
With characteristic Highland hospitality, both shelter and supper were offered with alacrity, and after a warm bowl of brose and fresh oatcake, both visitors had been accommodated with a pallet before the fire.
There was scarce room to lay a quilt by the hearth, and we were squeezed a bit, but we lay down side by side and made ourselves as comfortable as might be.
He drew a deep breath and looked at me half shyly.
"Well, I was worn out by the journey and slept deep, and I suppose Ian did the same. But he slept every night with Jenny for the last 5 years, and I suppose, having a worn body next to him in the bed... Well, somewhere in the night he rolled toward me, put his arm about me and kissed me on the back of the neck. And I..."
He hesitated, and I could see the deep colour flood his face even in the greyish light of the snow-lit room.
"I woke from a sound sleep, thinking he was Jack Randall."
I had been holding my breath through this story. Now I let it out slowly.
"That must have been the hell of a shock," I said.
One side of Jamie's mouth twitched.
"It was the hell of a shock to Ian, I'll tell you," he said. "I rolled over and punched him in the face. And by the time I came all the way to myself, I was on top of him, throttling him, with his tongue sticking out of his head. Hell of a shock to the Murrays in the bed, too," he added reflectively. "I told them I'd had a nightmare. Well, I had, in a way. But it caused the hell of a stramash, what with the bairn shrieking and Ian choking in the corner, and Mrs. Murray sitting bolt upright in bed, saying, 'Hoo, hoo,' like a wee fat owl."
I laughed, despite myself, at the image.
"Oh, God, Jamie.
Was Ian all right?" Jamie shrugged a little.
"Well, you saw him. Everyone went back to sleep after a time, and I just lay before the fire for the rest of the night, staring at the roof beams."
He didn't resist as I picked up his left hand, gently stroking the bruised knuckles. His fingers closed over mine, holding them.
"So, when we left the next morning," he went on, "I waited till we'd come to a spot where he can sit and look over the valley below. And then..."
He swallowed, and his hand tightened slightly on mine.
"I told him about Randall and everything that happened."
I began to understand the ambiguity of the look Ian had given Jamie. And now I understood the look of strain on Jamie's face and the smudges under his eyes. Not knowing what to say, I just squeezed his hands.
"I hadn't thought I'd ever tell anyone. Anyone but you,"
he added, returning the squeeze. He smiled briefly, then pulled one hand away to rub his face.
"But Ian Well, he's...
He groped for the right word.
He knows me, do you see?
I think so. You've known him all your life, haven't you? He nodded, looking sightlessly out the window. The swirling snow had begun to fall again, small flakes dancing against the pane, whiter than the sky.
He's only a year older than me. When I was growing, he was always there. Until I was 14, there wasn't a day went by when I didn't see Ian. And even later, after going to Foster wi Dugal and to Leoch, and then later still to Paris, to university, when I'd come back, I'd walk round a corner, and there he would be, and it would be like I'd never left. He'd just smile when he saw me, like he always did, and then we'd be walking away together, side by side, over the fields and the streams, talking of everything.
He sighed deeply, and rubbed a hand through his hair.
Ian, he's the part of me that belongs here, that never left, he said,
struggling to explain.
I thought, I must tell him. I didn't want to feel apart from Ian, from here.
He gestured toward the window, then turned toward me, eyes dark in the dim light.
Do you see why?
I think so, I said again, softly. Did Ian? He made that small, uncomfortable shrugging motion, as though easing a shirt too tight across his back.
Well, I couldn't tell. At first, when I began to tell him, he just kept shaking his head, as though he couldn't believe me, and then, when he did...
He paused and licked his lips, and I had some idea of just how much that confession in the snow had cost him.
I could see he wanted to jump to his feet and stamp back and forth, but he couldn't, because of his leg. His fists were knotted up and his face was white, and he kept saying, "How? Damn you, Jamie, how could you let him do it?"
He shook his head.
I don't remember what I said, or what he said. We shouted at each other, I know that much. And I wanted to hit him, but I couldn't because of his leg. And he wanted to hit me, but couldn't because of his leg.
He gave a brief snort of laughter.
Christ, we must have looked a rare pair of fools waving our arms and shouting at each other. But I shouted longer, and finally he shut up and listened to the end of it. And all of a sudden I couldn't go on talking. It just seemed like no use. And I sat down all at once on a rock and put my head in my hands. And after a time Ian said we'd best be going on, and I nodded and got up and helped him on his horse, and we started off again, not speaking to each other.
Jamie seemed suddenly to realise how tightly he was holding my hand. He released his grip, but continued to hold my hand, turning my wedding ring between his thumb and forefinger.
"We rode for a long time," he said softly. And then I heard a small sound behind me and reined up so Ian's horse came alongside. And I could see he'd been weeping, still was, with the tears streaming down his face. And he saw me look at him and shook his head hard as if he was still angry. But then he held out his hand to me. I took it, and he gave me a squeeze. Hard enough to break the bones. Then he let go, and we came on home.
I could feel the tension go out of him with the ending of the story.
"Be well, brother,"
Ian had said, balanced on his one leg in the bedroom door.
"It's all right, then?" I asked. "It will be."
He relaxed completely now, sinking back into the goose-down pillows. I slid down under the quilts beside him and lay close, fitted against his side. We watched the snow fall, hissing softly against the glass.
"I'm glad you're safe home," I said.
I woke to the same grey light in the morning. Jamie, already dressed for the day, was standing by the window.
"Oh, you're awake, Sassenach," he said,
seeing me lift my head from the pillow.
"That's good. I brought you a present."
He reached into his sporran and pulled out several copper doits, two or three small rocks, a short stick wrapped with fish line, a crumpled letter, and a tangle of hair ribbons.
"Hair ribbons," I said. "Thank you, they're lovely."
"No, those aren't for you," he said,
frowning as he disengaged the blue strands from the mole's foot he carried as a charm against rheumatism.
"They're for wee Maggie."
He squinted dubiously at the rocks remaining in his palm. To my astonishment, he picked one up and licked it.
"No, not that one," he muttered,
and dived back into his sporran. "What on earth do you think you're doing?" I inquired with interest, watching this performance. He didn't answer, but came out with another handful of rocks, which he sniffed at, discarding them one by one, until he came to a nodule that struck his fancy. This one he licked once, for certainty, then dropped it into my hand, beaming.
"Amber," he said, with satisfaction,
as I turned the irregular lump over with a forefinger. It seemed warm to the touch, and I closed my hand over it almost unconsciously.
"It needs polishing, of course," he explained, "but I thought it would make ye a bonny necklace."
He flushed slightly, watching me.
"It's a gift for our first year of marriage. When I saw it, I was minded of the bit of amber Hugh Monroe gave you when we wed."
"I still have that," I said softly, caressing the odd little lump of petrified tree sap. Hugh's chunk of amber, one side sheared off and polished into a small window, had a dragonfly embedded in the matrix, suspended in eternal flight. I kept it in my medicine box, the most powerful of my charms. A gift for our first anniversary.
We had married in June, of course, not in December. But on the date of our first anniversary, Jamie had been in the Bastille, and I had been in the arms of the King of France. No time for a celebration of wedded bliss, that. "It's nearly Hogmanay," Jamie said, looking out the window at the soft snowfall that blanketed the fields of Lallybroch. "It seems a good time for beginnings," I thought.
"I think so, too." I got out of bed and came to him at the window, putting my arms around his waist. We stayed locked together, not speaking, until my eye suddenly fell on the other small yellowish lumps that Jamie had removed from his sporran.
"What on earth are those things, Jamie?" I asked, letting go of him long enough to point.
"Och, those. They're honey balls, Sassenach."
He picked up one of the objects, dusting at it with his fingers.
"Mrs. Gibson in the village gave them to me. Very good, though they got a bit dusty in my sporran, I'm afraid."
He held out his open hand to me, smiling.
"Want one?"
Chapter 34. The postman always rings twice. I didn't know what or how much Ian had told Jenny of his conversation in the snow with Jamie. She behaved toward her brother just as always, matter-of-fact and acerbic, with a slight touch of affectionate teasing. I had known her long enough, though, to realize that one of Jenny's greatest gifts was her ability to see something with utter clarity, and then to look straight through it, as though it wasn't there. The dynamics of feeling and behavior shifted among the four of us during the months, and settled into a pattern of solid strength, based on friendship and founded in work. Mutual respect and trust were simply a necessity. There was so much to be done. As Jenny's pregnancy progressed, I took on more and more of the domestic duties, and she deferred to me more often. I would never try to usurp her place. She had been the axis of the household since the death of her mother, and it was to her that the servants or tenants most frequently came. Still, they grew used to me, treating me with a friendly respect which bordered sometimes on acceptance, and sometimes on awe. The spring was marked first by the planting of an enormous crop of potatoes. Over half the available land was given to the new crop, a decision justified within weeks by a hailstorm that flattened the new-sprung barley. The potato vines, creeping low and stolid over the ground, survived. The second event of the spring was the birth of a second daughter, Catherine Mary, to Jenny and Ian. She arrived with a suddenness that startled everyone, including Jenny. One day, Jenny complained of an aching back and went to lie down. Very shortly, it became clear what was really happening, and Jamie went post-haste for Mrs. Martins, the midwife. The two of them arrived back just in time to share in a celebratory glass of wine as the thin, high squalls of the new arrival echoed through the halls of the house. And so the year burgeoned and greened, and I bloomed, the last of my hurts healing in the heart of love and work. Letters arrived irregularly. Sometimes they would be mailed once a week. Sometimes nothing would come for a month or more. Considering the lengths to which messengers had to go to deliver mail in the Highlands, I thought it incredible that anything ever arrived. Today, though, there was a large packet of letters and books, wrapped against the weather in a sheet of oiled parchment tied with twine. Sending the postal messenger to the kitchen for refreshment, Jenny untied the string carefully and thriftily stowed it in her pocket. She thumbed through the small pile of letters, putting aside for the moment an enticing-looking package addressed from Paris. "A letter for Ian. That'll be the bill for the seed, I expect. And one from Auntie Jocasta. Oh, good. We've not heard from her in months. I thought she might be ill, but I see her hand is firm on the pen." A letter addressed with bold black strokes fell onto Jenny's pile, followed by a note from one of Jocasta's married daughters. Then another for Ian from Edinburgh, one for Jamie from Jared, I recognised the spidery, half-legible writing, and another, a thick, creamy sheet sealed with the royal crest of the House of Stuart. Another of Charles's complaints about the rigours of life in Paris and the pains of intermittently requited love, I imagined. At least this one looked short. Usually he went on for several pages, unburdening his soul to Cher Jam in a misspelled quadrilingual patois that at least made it clear he sought no secretarial help for his personal letters. "Oh, three French novels and a book of poetry from Paris," Jenny said in excitement, opening the paper-wrapped package. "C'est un embarras de richesse, hm? What shall we read tonight?" She lifted the small stack of books from their wrappings, stroking the soft leather cover of the top one with a forefinger that trembled with delight. Jenny loved books with the same passion her brother reserved for horses. The manor boasted a small library, in fact, and if the evening leisure between work and bed was short, still it usually included at least a few minutes' reading. "It gives you something to think on as you go about your work," Jenny explained, when I found her one night swaying with weariness and urged her to go to bed rather than stay up to read aloud to Ian, Jamie, and myself. She yawned, fist to her mouth. "Even if I'm say tired, I hardly see the words on the page. They'll come back to me next day, churning or spinning or walking wool, and I can turn them over in my mind." I hid a smile at the mention of wool walking. Alone among the Highland farms, I was sure the women of Lallybroch walked their wool not only to the old traditional chants, but also to the rhythms of Molière and Piron. I had a sudden memory of the walking shed, where the women sat in two facing rows, barefooted and bare-armed in their oldest clothes, bracing themselves against the walls as they thrust with their feet against the long, sodden worm of woolen cloth, battering it into the tight, felted weave that would repel Highland mists and even light rain, keeping the wearer safe from the chill. Every so often, one woman would rise and go outside to fetch the kettle of steaming urine from the fire. Skirts kilted high, she would walk spraddle-legged down the centre of the shed, drenching the cloth between her legs, and the hot fumes rose fresh and suffocating from the soaking wool, while the walkers pulled back their feet from random splashes and made crude jokes. "Hot piss sets the dye fast," one of the women had explained to me as I blinked, eyes watering on my first entrance to the shed. The other woman had watched at first to see if I would shrink back from the work, but wool-walking